From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
I'm telling you, November 8th, we better be careful because that election's going to be rigged. And I hope the Republicans are watching closely or it's going to be taken away from us.
That was Republican presidential hopeful Donald Trump speaking about rigged elections in a TV interview with Sean Hannity on Fox News.
Last time there were, you had precincts where there were practically nobody voting for the Republican, and I think that's wrong. I think that was unfair, frankly, to Mitt Romney. You had areas where a lot of people were curious, how is that possible? And I've been hearing about it for a long time, and I just hope that there's really, I hope the Republicans get out there and watch very closely, because I think we're going to win this election. But if it's rigged, like anything else, look, it was rigged, I thought, a little bit for me, and we won in landslides. I think it was rigged against Bernie Sanders with his super delegates nonsense.
Absolutely. Well, we know it was rigged.
The guy never had
a chance.
Of course the elections will not be rigged. What does that mean? The federal government doesn't run the election process. States and cities and communities all across the country, they're the ones who set up the voting systems and the voting booths. And if Mr. Trump is suggesting that there is a conspiracy theory that is being propagated across the country, including in places like Texas, where typically it's not Democrats who are in charge of voting booths, that's ridiculous. That doesn't make any sense. And I don't think anybody would take that seriously.
Bob Fitrakis is an attorney and political science professor in the state of Ohio who has extensive experience litigating election fraud, including the fraud that took place, he says, during the 2004 election. We spoke with him via Skype on Tuesday.
It's clearly possible, and in fact, it looks like somebody rigged the primaries. The question of who could rig this, the obvious problem is you've got partisan, for-profit corporations with secret proprietary software. Our system in the U.S. is designed to be rigged, and it's been pretty much that way since the rise of mainframe computers. The problem was looked at and discussed beginning in the 1964 election with mainframe computers being used as tabulators. So what's interesting is just prior to this, the elite press had all agreed that the Russians could possibly hack our election.
Right.
They forget the people who have the keys to the kingdom,
yeah.
Seidel, ESNS. Dominion, Hard Inner Civic, these private companies with this secret proprietary software that do everything from the databases, the voting databases, to the e-polling books, to the election night reporting, to the central tabulation, and the final reports. In a company like Seidel is absolutely one-stop shopping, and it has long connections and interlocking boards with the people that from the Carlyle Group and other Booz Allen Hamilton, which Snowden came out of the whistleblower. So obviously this can happen. I mean, Trump's big problem is he's basically focusing for a time there on voter fraud, which isn't the real problem. I mean, there's clearly some problems with the voter databases. You know, why can't county or state board of elections hook up with the county recorders, and when somebody dies, you eliminate them from the ballot?
Right.
But I think part of the ability to commit fraud is having a surplus of voters, because these companies that do this have, and the political campaigns have detailed data, mega data, metadata, geospatial. So they can actually, if they need to concoct a plausible cyber vote, they can.
We'll bring you more details in that full interview with Bob Fitrakis, the election law attorney, later this week. While reports of the wars in the Middle East pour in through the mainstream media daily, Africa has been at war for decades with tens of millions of casualties, and those wars receive almost no coverage in the U.S. at all. For more on what's happening in Africa, we spoke with Abiyomi Ezekwe, who's the senior editor of the Pan-African Newswire. It's been too long. A pleasure to have you with us.
Thank you.
So, you know, everybody's paying attention to the wars that are going on in the Middle East and perhaps the threat of war with Russia and or China by the U.S. And yet the bodies have been piling up for maybe two decades in Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's still happening. Maybe you want to talk about that a little bit.
Right now, there's a big controversy over the upcoming elections in the Democratic Republic of Congo because the interim president, Joseph Kabila, by the mandate of the Constitution, is supposed to hold elections. They're supposed to be held this year. They've been postponed. And, of course, this is providing a lot of problems for the government because the opposition is utilizing this to stir up the population to engage in all types of demonstrations. And then in the east of the country, the situation has been unstable there at least since 1996 when the forces that emerged in opposition to Mobutu Sese Seko entered the country, and eventually his government was toppled in 1997. Then in the following year, Rwanda and Uganda, which had assisted him in taking power, turned around and wanted to oust him. And this, of course, prompted the intervention of the Southern African Development Community, which the military portfolio at the time was held by Zimbabwe. And Angola, Zimbabwe, and Namibia entered the DRC, in order to defend the government of Laurent Kabila. Kabila was assassinated in 2001, and then the war had a negotiated end in 2003, but there's been periodic rebellions in the east over the last 8 years, and so it's still a very, very volatile situation. The DRC is a very rich country in regard to strategic minerals. And this, of course, has been a curse on the country, even going back to the days of colonialism, when the Belgian monarchy had set it up as more or less an overseas corporation for the benefit of King Leopold, who ruled the country as his own private property for decades until it was taken over by the Belgian government. And it wasn't too much better at that time, after 1908, and between 1908 and 1960, they ruled the country with an iron fist. And in 1960, when Lumumba took over, in the first election that was ever held since the period of colonialism, his government was destabilized, overthrown. He was driven into exile inside the country, and then eventually captured, kidnapped, executed. So the country has had tremendous turmoil over the last 55, 56 years.
Yeah, you know, like, for example, when they did all of that to Lumumba and chopped his body into little pieces, just to accentuate the point, one of the methods of destabilizing his government was to try to break away Katanga province, to basically partition the country into the area where the people were and the area where the minerals that the Belgians and the Americans and everybody else wanted were. You know, you have all this wealth, both of people and of minerals and such, across the African continent, and it's been, as you said, a curse for many years, because it's caught the attention of the most rapacious people on the planet, who've gone in there and sacked and murdered and such for centuries now. We're seeing a resurgence of the colonial order that started to collapse after World War II in one form or another. And the installation of U.S. AFRICOM in over the past 5 years across the continent after the assassination of Gaddafi and the arrest by the French of Gbagbo and others. You have this tug of war going on the across the continent, supposedly between China and the U.S., but really between the right of self-determination and the U.S. Maybe you could tell us how DRC fits into that struggle.
The Soviet Union had supported the Mouvement National Congrès Lumumba, which was Patrice Lumumba's political party. And the United States had supported the other factions, the Kasavubu faction, and Bas Congo, and also the faction that was headed by Moshe Shombe, who was a secessionist and was based in the south of the country in the Katanga province, which is rich with mineral resources as well. And so as a result of that, they were able to frame the conflict in 1960 and 61 as a even beyond that point, as a struggle against communism and Soviet influence or Chinese influence or Cuban influence in Africa. And that was their narrative from the early 1960s all the way through the late 1980s. Since that time period, they continued to support Mobutu, and they've continued to interfere in the internal affairs of the Democratic Republic of Congo. So today, we hear less about the threat of communism and more about the threat of Islamic terrorism. And also in Africa, as you mentioned, the Pentagon established its own command structure just for the continent. The United States Africa Command, and they're based in Stuttgart, Germany, but they have a base in Djibouti at Camp Le Monet, which has thousands of U.S. troops along with French troops as well. And they're close to the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea, and right across from the nation of Yemen, where war is being waged right now against the Ansarullah, the Shia, so-called Houthi, forces there in alliance with a previous government of Ali Abdullah Saleh, and they're fighting against the Hadi government, which had been ousted last year. The U.S. is supporting them, so is Saudi Arabia. Now, they claim that they had reached a ceasefire a couple of days ago. They claim they've negotiated a ceasefire earlier today. So we'll see what type of stability and peace this brings to Yemen. But that whole area, we'll be talking about Yemen, we could talk about Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Syria, the whole so-called Arabian Peninsula and the Horn of Africa are connected by the determination of the United States and the European Union countries and NATO to dominate that part of the world for various reasons. Oil is one. Also, access to these strategic waterways in the Gulf of Aden, the Red Sea. You also have North Africa, which is important, leading into the Mediterranean and Southern Europe. So it's another form of a Cold War that is in existence today, with the United States on one side, the European Union and NATO, on the other side, of course, being the Russian Federation, China and the countries that are either allied with Russia or are acting even in a minuscule fashion independent of the United States.
And that particular area, you know, along the north and east part of Africa, you know, China is perceived as the rival of the United States. And as the United States tries to wrap its arm around Africa, basically, that is the point of contact where the string of pearls leads from essentially from China to Africa. And that is the wall that they're putting up to keep China out.
Yeah, there's a huge a concern on the part of Washington about growing influence of the People's Republic of China with African Union member states. They had set up the Forum for China-Africa Cooperation, and they've been holding summits for the last decade and a half. In China, there was also one in South Africa last year. But at the same time, the U.S. Is escalating its military, diplomatic, and intelligence involvement in Africa. Somalia is an excellent example. Even in the New York Times on Sunday, they had a fairly extensive article about the U.S. so-called secret war that's not so secret in Somalia. So this is an ongoing struggle, and it's not going to end irrespective of who is put in the White House next month or in January, who's elected to be put in the White House in January, whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats. These issues are not even discussed during the debates or any political discourse involving the two parties in the United States at this time. It's a lot of personal attacks in order to avoid the real issues that are facing people in this country and in the world.
Yeah, and you know, looking across the landscape of Africa, of course, I mean, the potential of China to help develop Africa with the model that it uses, where it tries to uplift its customers, basically, and its trading partners, so they can get rich enough to either buy Chinese products or build them in their own country and send money back to Beijing. It's a different model from the U.S. And EU loot model, and with its with all the flaws that it has. The competition between these two blocks has been also very active, although China has played a soft hand in Latin America. And so one can imagine that you have tensions across the continent between these two models, you know, that are expressed in political circles and maybe even in some places potentially in the streets. I know that there's fighting over this in terms of influence that's going on in South Africa. Do you want to talk about that a little bit?
Yeah, in South Africa now, the ANC government is facing tremendous challenges due to the destabilization, systematic destabilization of the country by the U.S. And there's also a problem with the economy because since the decline of apartheid, there's been a gradual disinvestment of private capital from South Africa. That's taken the form of the closing of mines, the downsizing of industrial production. So there's a huge problem of unemployment. And as a result of this, there's a huge debate over how to proceed within the tripartite alliance, which was the alliance that actually secured the advancement of the ANC party. You have the African National Congress, there's the Congress of South African Trade Unions, and the South African Communist Party are the three main organizations that have been operating the South African state over the last 22 years. But there are sharp differences within the alliance right now. And also, what has happened is that the ANC has of course, faced a challenge from the Democratic Alliance and also the Economic Freedom Fighters. Now, the Democratic Alliance is more of a neoliberal, even right-wing political party, but they've been recruiting a lot of Africans, particularly young Africans who are unemployed or who are middle-class people who feel that they could advance better outside of an ANC government. And then the Economic Freedom Fighters, of course, were expelled. They were part of the ANC Youth League. They were expelled several years ago and in turn formed their own political party. And they block with the Democratic Alliance, even though they claim to be an ultra-left formation. So that is the challenge they're facing right now. And the currency is declining, the South African rand. There's factional problems inside the ANC. As COSATU, the National Union of Metal Workers of South Africa, were expelled 2 years ago from the COSATU alliance, NUMSA. They said they were going to form their own alliance, another trade union alliance, which I have not seen. They also said they were going to form a socialist party, independent of the South African Communist Party. I have not seen that either. So they were accused of being workerist and anarchist, syndicalist type of orientation politically. That remains to be seen. But you have these divisions that are taking place, and it's taking place amid a growing economic crisis in the global South, with the decline in oil prices, the decline in commodity prices, and also the escalation of U.S. Subversion.
You know, there are many that suspected that the drive down of oil and other commodity prices was economic warfare being conducted against Russia, Venezuela, Iran, and South Africa. What resources does the South, you know, as you've said, as most observers agree that are paying attention, you look at the difference between the conditions that existed in South Africa after the abolition of apartheid, say, as against the program followed in Zimbabwe, or perhaps even something more assertive, when you had all of this wealth stolen by people in Europe, by Europeans, and ultimately by transnational corporations, that should properly belong to the people of the country. And
yes,
governments that, you know, at least theoretically recognize the need to, you know, to take these properties back. Yet, is anyone really proposing that program for South Africa, which would allow the government to, the resources to get back to work?
Yeah, the EFF, the Economic Freedom Fighters under Julius Malema, said that was their program, but they only constitute maybe 6 or 7% of the electorate. And as questions, people have raised questions about whether that's really their program or whether it's just demagogy to gain votes. But according to the ANC and the SACP program, and COSATU as well, they're supposed to be committed to socialism. They're supposed to be committed to the nationalization of resources. However, saying that on the one hand and being able to enact it on the other hand are two vastly different things. They're still very well integrated into the world capitalist system. And if they decided to nationalize the mines or the banks or perhaps the other institutions, manufacturing institutions in South Africa, and land, agricultural land and farmland, they would suffer the same type of sanctions as Zimbabwe has undergone since 2000. And Zimbabwe waited for 20 years before they took over large sections of white-owned farmland, which they had stolen in the late 19th century under the British. But you see the impact of this on Zimbabwe. The economy now is teetering on the brink of collapse. There's huge shortages of consumer goods, of currency. Their own national currency collapsed about 5 years ago. And they used principally the U.S. dollar. And there's a huge shortage of dollars inside the country. So you have people who cannot get currency. The government has been contemplating introducing another form of alternative exchange, bond coins, bond notes, but they have not issued them yet because there's a lot of concern about that in terms of the value of it and what impact it would have on the economy. So there's a price to pay for standing up against imperialism. Even stronger countries, for example, like Russia, Brazil, and also China have also, it's impacted them as well, particularly Russia with the sanctions that are leveled against them by the U.S. and by the EU over Ukraine and over Crimea. So Iran has suffered for decades as a result of sanctions, and there's still a proxy war going on with Iran now in Yemen, being waged largely by the United States. So these are some of the complexities of what these countries that are emerging are facing. But at the same time, the economies in Europe and the North American economies are not that strong either. You know, they speak in terms of a recovery, in terms of some stability. But if you compare, for example, the annual economic growth rate in China, which was 6.7% in the last quarter, but what it is in the United States is barely above 1%, if that, then it means that the U.S. System is not that stable either. Neither is Britain. They never even talk about hardly their economy. In the aftermath of the Brexit vote, the Bank of England had to engage in quantitative easing. They admitted openly that they were going to go into a recession. And even in countries like France and others have huge unemployment rates, not to mention Spain, Portugal, Greece. So this is a worldwide economic crisis. And the U.S. is trying to shield itself through these interventions, these military interventions, and this seizure of resources and exploitation of labor.
And you're one of at one of the, if not the epicenter of that economic, you know, degradation or collapse. Yes. In the United States, in Detroit. Maybe you could relate what's been happening there. First, inform people what's been happening there, you know, flesh it out for them, and then maybe relate it to the whole.
Well, yeah, we started this group called the Michigan Emergency Committee Against War and Injustice in 2002, and one of our slogans was money for our cities, not for war. That kind of sums it up, that if you look at the Pentagon budget, and if you combine the Pentagon budget of about maybe $500 or $600 billion annually, and you combine that with the intelligence and homeland security budgets and nuclear weapons, allocations for nuclear weapons research and development and deployment, we're looking at well over $1 trillion annually for a security and military apparatus that ostensibly sees its greatest enemy as being Islamic terrorism. At least that's their propaganda. But we know that they consider Russia, they consider China, they consider Iran as some of their principal enemies. So Detroit has been suffering like other cities all across the United States, people being thrown out of their homes, the public school systems collapsing, teachers very dissatisfied, being laid off, having to teach under very deplorable conditions. We have a water infrastructure here that is under siege by the capitalist class, and environmental degradation as well. It's becoming impossible to live in certain parts of the city, particularly in the southwest area, where there's all types of pollution as a result of a oil refinery. So these problems are going on in Detroit, but they're happening in other cities as well, like Chicago, Cleveland, New York City, Memphis. It's a nationwide problem.
And finally, looking at both the international and the national situation and acknowledging that electoral politics in the United States does not have the impact on policy that is touted or that many people believe, what do you think people should be doing looking at the electoral landscape, if anything?
Yeah, I think the electoral politics could be useful if people have strong, independent political parties. But those political parties have to be associated with the mass and popular struggles of labor, for example, the whole struggle now to raise the minimum wage inside the United States for housing, to guarantee housing, to guarantee water, utility services, and to end the military-industrial complex and the prison-industrial complex. This is where people, this is the direction that we have to move in. You know, people look for, you know, other alternatives. The Bernie Sanders campaign, you know, mobilized millions of people, but when the candidacy was stolen by Clinton, the Clintonians, Sanders abandoned his own followers. And, of course, is telling people to vote for Hillary Clinton. I don't think a lot of those people will vote for Hillary Clinton. Some will, but some won't. So I think people have to do the hard work of organizing. That is the most difficult challenge right now facing working people and oppressed people in this country.
Ezekwe, thank you very much, and look forward to updates at the Pan-African Newswire.
Thank you so much.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.